Well, I've had days that I'd like to whoop him upside the head with me shillelagh, but I suppose he isn't such a bad fella. Here comes the colonel.
Yeah. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you, too. Welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. In just a minute, we're going to get back with Paul Frenger. He's a conservationist, says he's that rather than an environmentalist, and believes in using natural resources in a responsible and sustainable way. He's going to talk about refrigerant-free air conditioning and edible organic semiconductors. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Ed Morris from UC Berkeley is going to be back with us, and he has some very, very good insight on what's going on right now with the Iranian nuclear dust-up that we hear about in the news all the time. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Ah, yes. Once again, the Spirit of the Fountain has joined us for today's query. All right. Oh, Spirit of the Fountain, here's a history question for you. What war was raging when isolationists adopted the motto, America First? Okay, the motto, America First, was adopted by isolationists during what war?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell the others.
Well. It seems our Spirit of the Fountain knows his history. The war that was raging when isolationists adopted the motto, America First, it was World War I. Yeah, a lot of hesitation to get into that one. All right, back to our program. Now then, you have two presentations you're going to be making at the Green Tech Conference. One is a paper, refrigerant free air conditioning, which I want to get into in just a little bit, and another is a poster entitled "Edible Organic Semiconductors." Now, why would we want to eat our semiconductors?
Probably you would not. The point I'm trying to make with that particular poster, "Edible Organic Semiconductors," is that by using completely natural components, one can put together electronics that does not hurt the environment.
All right. So drill down a little bit on this for us. Explain what the use is and why that's important.
Well, first of all, it strikes me that there is a lot of technology that has been discovered in the past and then lost, so that we don't realize that this material or these particular techniques already exist. For example, with this organic semiconductor material, the original research was discovered in 1862 that a chemical which is in melanin, a natural pigment, had electrical switching characteristics.
Okay.
And that was 1862.
Right.
This little kernel of information was completely lost until 38 years ago. So the original discovery, which was quite monumental in a way, and led to a lot of technology we have today, it came and it went and then got lost again.
Well, okay. In 1862, somebody discovered that organisms can have electrical properties. But in 1862, nobody's going to... What possible use could that be? They weren't doing anything in 1862. So I can understand why it would be lost. What's the practical application of these things, anyway?
Well, first of all, a little bit of context. This is approximately the time that Jules Verne was writing his novel 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea,
mm-hmm.
and where the incredible Captain Nemo built his submarine. I gave a presentation at NASA a couple of years ago talking about, the title was Lost Technologies of Jules Verne and the Nautilus Submarine.
Oh, yeah?
And in that, I talked about the possibility that Captain Nemo could have invented the first microprocessor for controlling his submarine. And the second thing was talking about the power source of the Nautilus, which could have been atomic power. So the time frame was perfect the middle of the 1860s, which is when that was written.
Okay.
Right. No electronics done at that point. The calculation machines available to human beings back in those days were all mechanical. You turn the crank, and the gears inside do the calculation, and then you got your answer on a mechanical readout. So electronics were really not even on the horizon at that point.
Well, then it's natural that these, you know, this would be lost, and why resurrect it now? I mean, obviously we haven't found a use for it since then, so what's the practical point now?
Well, if you have a telephone with a light-emitting diode display, that telephone display could be what we call an OLED, which is an organic light-emitting diode, and that it does use an organic semiconductor. Those are very useful because, number one, they're much cheaper to manufacture than a silicon-based transistor, and they can be produced at lower temperatures and with less damage to the environment because they don't use a lot of chemicals which can poison the environment. So it looks like we're making some progress away from silicon and other kinds of metallic semiconductors towards much more practical organic semiconductors, which, again, are environmentally friendly.
Well, you're really into environmentally friendly things, aren't you? I mean, you don't like electric cars, and you're not happy with the batteries that we're using nowadays. In fact, is even nuclear fuel. You've got a lot to talk about. Expand on these things for us.
Well, first of all, I don't mind the concept of an electric car, and I think it's a good idea in many respects. But I'm not very crazy about two things in electric cars. Number one is the motors. The electric motors that we're using right now use a lot of rare earth materials to make the motors more efficient. The problem with that is they're in short supply, which means there'll be a lot of competition between different countries and different users for that particular material. And the second thing is that those things, when you process them for a motor, again, you release a lot of toxic materials into the environment. Okay. The second thing about electric cars I'm not crazy about are batteries. Now, I think the fuel cells may make a much better source of electricity for an electric car than a battery. Unfortunately, batteries often contain heavy metals again and other materials which are harmful to the environment during their processing. So the thing there is that if we can make an electric car that doesn't damage the environment during its manufacture, then we'd be in good shape. And by the way, some people also refer to these electric cars as coal-powered. If you've never heard that phrase before, you might think about this for a moment. But when you plug your electric car into the electricity grid, most of that electricity is not coming from renewable resources. It's coming from coal plants. And we all know that coal can be a fairly dirty material to produce electricity. So all you're doing is you're changing from one dirty fuel source, for example, petroleum, to another dirty fuel source, which is coal. And that by itself, I don't think, is much of an improvement.
Well, of course, you're touching on a point that is widely talked about as being a negative for electric cars, because half of our electricity currently comes from coal. But those who would argue against you on that would point out that we're rapidly moving to a natural gas environment, because the United States has got, like, what, 200 years worth of natural gas, and the strides that are being made in photovoltaics and capturing electricity from heat transfer looks like it's going to be exponential. So the future does not hold that we're going to be still generating half of our electricity from coal. It looks like it's going to come from other sources. So would you still have the same reservations about electric cars?
Well, if those kind of improvements could be done, I think that would be great. But remember, with photovoltaics, you have to have exposure to the sun. As you begin to put more and more of these on the surface of the earth, you make less available for planting crops, okay, because the crops have to have sun too. So I'm in favor of any technology that does not reduce the food supply for human beings or cause other kinds of unexpected side effects that could be harmful. So I'm all in favor of technology, and I'm all in favor of advances, but I think that we need to look at the entire picture for each of these and think about the unintended side effects that could occur. For example, by converting corn into alcohol for fuel, one of the unintended side effects there has been that it creates food shortages and raises the price of food for people that can't afford to pay. So we have to be careful about those side effects.
Yeah, I think that we've really come to realize, and it isn't popular with the farmers in Illinois and in Iowa, that we've kind of woke up to the fact that making alcohol to burn in our vehicles is not the greatest idea because it diminishes the food supply. So as fast as that grew in popularity, it looks like that's kind of going away. What is this... You were talking about the toxic metals and that sort of thing, the rare earth materials, but doesn't it look like the source is going to be someday Afghanistan, that it's rich in those materials, and that's going to be the very thing that that brings Afghanistan into the 21st century with its economy, because it is a payload of those rare earth metals?
Well, you know, Afghanistan would be wonderful if they were stable politically, geopolitically, and I'm all in favor of them being able to have products to sell other than perhaps opium, which unfortunately is one of their big products at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the problem is, regardless of where you drill into the earth to produce this material, you're still going to be releasing toxic materials into the environment. So the biosphere is everywhere, and once you start releasing things, for example, into the water or into the atmosphere, what goes around comes around, and it'll be there on your front steps. I understand that debris from the Japanese tsunami last year is already floating towards our west coast. So, like I said, what goes around comes around, and just because you release that material in Afghanistan doesn't mean you won't be breathing it a year or so later here in the United States.
So Afghanistan better get busy real fast and start developing these rare earth materials, because they're going to go out of vogue pretty soon when we start replacing them with other things. That's what you're saying?
Yes, perhaps.
All right, now let's get into this refrigerant-free air conditioning. Your grandmother had an ammonia air conditioner, and I'm sure that there's people in the audience that probably know what we're talking about, but I don't. So you think that the refrigerant free air conditioning is time has come, and maybe time is long overdue. Drill down on that for us just a little bit.
Absolutely. Now, refrigerant technology is very, very old. Jacob Perkins in 1834 built the first refrigerant-based heat cycle machine, and it used ether, you know, like you would use, for example, for anesthesia way back when.
Mm-hmm.
It worked just fine, but the problem was that ether is explosive and toxic, so that's not a very good idea. Over a period of time, other kinds of refrigerators have been built, and they also use dangerous chemicals. And I talked about ammonia in my grandmother's icebox. It was a wonderful icebox, but if it ever had developed a leak, it could have poisoned all of us to death.
Yeah.
Other chemicals that have been used, which are also very toxic, are sulfur dioxide, methane, carbon dioxide, and the CFCs and the HCFCs, you know, the fluorocarbons like we have been using in our house for air conditioning or our cars for air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Those latter materials have been shown to damage the Earth's ozone layer.
Yeah.
Which would expose all of us to more radiation from the sun, which is very damaging and causing skin cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the point is, all of these refrigerants, they work very well for cooling, but the problem is their toxicity is variably high, and we would like to avoid them if we can. So, surprise, this old technology, which uses air only, there is no refrigerant. It takes the air itself which surrounds all of us, and it uses that to produce the cooling effect.
Now, how does the air around us can be hotter than Hades. I mean, how do you use the air around us for a cooling effect? I mean, we already use fans. Is that what you're talking about?
No, this is much more complicated. It turned out that a device called a vortex tube, I love that term, vortex tube, it's very descriptive, was invented in 1933 by a French physicist, mm-hmm. Georges Rankine.
Okay.
And he received a patent in the United States for it. But, unfortunately, it was never used, at least in his lifetime, for that purpose. And what these vortex tubes do is they take compressed air, and by using a spinning process, they transfer heat from one portion of the flow to another portion of the flow. And this tube, using no moving parts of its own, separates the moving air into a hot jet of gas and a cold jet of gas. And this cold jet of gas can be so cold that you can use it in an ice box to produce ice. All right? And there's nothing involved except just compressed air using this very interesting mechanical device.
Now, let me envision this for just a minute. You're talking about taking, let's say, hot air from a 110-degree day and forcing it into this vortex tube, which separates it into hot air and cool air, and the cool air is cool enough that it will actually make ice? Is that the picture I'm getting?
Yes, absolutely. It turns out that as long as the air is not so hot that it doesn't burn you up, it can be used in a vortex tube. The cooler the air, the compressed air that goes into the device, the cooler the air, the better efficiency you get.
Sure.
But nevertheless, fairly warm air can be used as a feedstock, as up to 200 degrees Fahrenheit can be used into this machine, and this vortex tube will separate the heat from the cold. Surprisingly enough, one of the original uses for this vortex tube was not cooling, but rather to separate gases. For example, oxygen and nitrogen, or carbon dioxide and helium, or carbon dioxide and air. This was discovered in 1967. But the original tube is probably best used for producing cold air with nothing more than just compressed air as its source.
All right, so then, let's see now. What are the drawbacks to this? You've got a vortex tube that somehow separates the hot from the cold, and you get extremely cold air on one, cold enough to freeze water, and on the other it generates the heat. So what you have to do if you wanted to cool, let's say, a house or something like that using this method, you'd have to somehow dispel this extremely hot air outside or into some other area so that you could cool a house. And then what about the power to run this particular vortex tube? I mean, where does that come from? Is it just right off the electrical grid, or what are we talking about? Is it terribly inefficient as far as a power source needed? Where are we going with this?
Well, first of all, whenever you produce heat in any fashion, you should try to find a way to use it for some useful purpose. Okay, so if you're talking about a house as opposed to, for example, an automobile,
okay,
if you're talking about a house, what you'd like to do is take the heat stream, the hot air, and use it, for example, to preheat the water in your water heater or some other use that you might have. Okay, that hot air can also be fed into a thermopile to produce heat, to produce electricity directly. That thermopile would be better described as thermo. Goodness, I've forgotten the word.
Okay.
Anyway, heat from the hot side can be used to produce electricity. You are right in one respect when you say that you have to be concerned about where does the compressed air come from. Now, in certain factories, you've got compressed air used all the time, and so a little extra compressed air could be bled off, for example, to cool electronic equipment or other kinds of equipment, which is being used at the factory. Of course, in houses, you don't have that. So you have to have a compressed air source. The first place you can have compressed air is by having your own compressor. And there are a variety of different kinds of compressor technologies that produce enough compressed air for you to use in a vortex tube. The minimum pressure that seems to work effectively is about 20 pounds per square inch, 20 psi.
Okay.
Most vortex tubes work much more efficiently from 80 to 100 psi. Okay. And there are a variety of ways of getting that that compressed air. The obvious thing is to have a compressor which runs off of electricity. But in my paper, I described the possibility of using, for example, windmills. Now, we already use windmills to produce electricity. You've probably seen them as you've driven along the road different places. I went to Wyoming a couple of years ago, and they have big wind farms, huge windmills to produce electricity. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't need a big windmill. All you need is one that'll fit in your backyard, for example. And to improve the efficiency, instead of going from wind to electricity and then from electricity back to pressure, one can go directly from wind into compressed air by driving not an electric generator but a piston pump. So depending upon where you get your compressed air, that will tell you roughly how efficient your overall process will be.
All right, now these vortex tubes. We had a lot more questions for Paul about the vortex tubes, and we ran out of time. So Paul is coming back next week and going to talk about his new patent that he has pending for the vortex tube. So we hope to see you then.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I'm afraid the other way around right now, that our Israeli brethren may be tempted to do something that they might regret later, like start World War III if they get too ugly with this. And the Iranians clearly are developing isotope separation technology. They had Ahmadinejad on television the other day, ostensibly showing off his centrifuges. You'll note that when he did that, he's standing in front of a table that was draped with a cloth. And so I don't know what that was all about, but clearly they have centrifuges. But remember that you use centrifuges to make nuclear fuel for reactors, and right now no country should be denied accessibility to nuclear power, because it's the only, you know, credible solution for not having a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere and getting out of our dependence on foreign oil and all those things. Frankly, we need to get some more qualified people in the State Department that understand these issues and have some nuclear savvy people in those organizations. It's right now, educationally, there's a great divide, and we have the engineers and scientists, and they go off and work for Department of Energy laboratories or in private companies, and then we have people with degrees in history and English and things like that going into the State Department, and so we have the scientifically technical people that couldn't name most of the countries in Eastern Europe on a map in one part of the country, the government, and we have the people that can hold the right fork and eat lunch with a prince but don't really know the difference between weapon-grade uranium and enriched uranium for a reactor. And that's what the problems are right now, is we haven't bred the master race of people that understand technology and can be at the plate in various functions that are government. My name is Edward C. Morse, and I am a professor of nuclear engineering at the University of California at Berkeley.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.